The House Revenue Committee meeting on this Friday morning, Valentine's Day, and welcome everybody here. We have welcome our guests, and apologize for our late start here, but it's always hard on Friday when we have floor to get everybody down here from the floor and back out of their offices. Normally, we are a very punctual 8:30 committee, but I do appreciate cities and counties being with us today for overview on the relationship between state finance and local government finance in particular. I see Hasina here. Is she going to talk to us about special districts finance too? Okay, thank you.
Hiding.
Yeah. Those eyes peeking up over the back of the chair.
I'm taking
And I will, let me offer one more apology before we get started, that I have a bill up in Transportation Committee that I will be buzzed for here at some point, and I'll have to excuse myself to go testify on. So with that, let's go ahead and start. Paul, do you have the...
I think we're going to start out with the cities, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Michelle Neister.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Happy Valentine's Day to all of you. Thanks for having me here today. I wanted to give a quick overview for all of you on city finances, our sources of funding, what we spend it on, and be available to answer additional questions for all of you today. So with that, I apologize for my low-tech approach here, but I thought fewer things could go wrong this way.
We're just glad it's not a film strip.
There you go. When Oregonians are asked where they live, most people identify themselves as coming from a city, Wilsonville, Baker City, you know, from all over the place. As you know, over two-thirds of Oregon residents live within city limits. Oregon cities have clearly identified personalities, Jacksonville, Joseph, Newport, Prineville, Portland, Corvallis. All of these have a look, a character, and a feel that make them very unique. These personalities are the result of each city's individual circumstances, their location, their resources, and the priorities that are expressed by their residents. There are 240 incorporated cities in Oregon, ranging from the largest, Portland, which has more than 538,000 residents, to the smallest, which is Granite, population 20. Let's see, the League represents 238 cities in this state. The two that aren't represented, in case you're wondering, are, for all practical intents and purposes, ghost towns. They're the cities of Lone Rock and Greenhorn, with populations of 2 and 5 residents, respectively.
Thank you, Michelle. I was going to ask about Greenhorn. Granite was the smallest. Okay.
So, although individual cities are diverse, there is general agreement on many principles and priorities, particularly in the realm of municipal finance and revenue decisions, and that's where the League comes in terms of representing them. So, and please feel free to stop me at any time if you folks have questions. City leadership is accountable to its constituents. Many residents, particularly in smaller communities, are likely to know or at least recognize their mayor and city councilors. Residents are likely to bump into these folks at grocery stores and Little League games and other events in their community. City officials are locally elected every 2 to 4 years, depending on the city's charter. We do feel that, you know, cities are the government closest to the people because there is that interaction, particularly in the smaller communities. except for Portland and Beaverton, locally elected leadership consists of volunteers, and that includes city budget committees, they include advisory committees, etc. City government and its advisory committees do make up one of the largest volunteer groups in the state. Cities do have public deliberations. City business is conducted in the open. There are stringent notice requirements, public hearings requirements, and all the deliberations take place in a public setting. And also, cities are subject to annual audit requirements. Their finances are reviewed by an outside auditor, and this information is a public document, and it's available for review by interested citizens. City authority is articulated in two places in the Oregon Constitution. Cities are basically Article 11, Section 2 says that the Legislative Assembly shall not enact, amend, or repeal any charter or act of incorporation for any municipality, city, or town. The legal voters of every city and town are hereby granted power to enact and amend their municipal charter, subject to the Constitution and criminal laws of the state of Oregon. Also, Measure 30 is the other place where cities are specifically mentioned in the state constitution. That was passed several years ago now, and basically says that when the Legislative Assembly or any state agency requires any local government to establish a new program or provide an increased level of service, for an existing program, the state of Oregon shall appropriate and allocate to the local governments money sufficient to pay for the ongoing usual and reasonable costs of performing the mandated service or activity. And there are several exceptions listed. There is a three-fifths majority requirement. If the legislature decides to impose a new program, then they don't have to provide the requisite additional funding. There are changes to the definition of a crime or federal mandates or judicial branch mandates are not covered by this particular measure. And that was voted, that was an initiative petition referred by this body to Oregonians and passed by them. I believe it was 1997? Okay. It is because each city is unique with its own challenges, character, and priorities that we assert that decisions directly affecting local communities are best made at the local level. You'll find city councilors fairly unanimous in their opinion that a one-size-fits-all approach is rarely appropriate. So now we get down to the nitty-gritty. Generally speaking, our primary source of revenue our property taxes. However, with the enactment of property tax limits, measures 5 and 4750, that is slowly dwindling in terms of importance. It used to be by far and away the largest source of cities' revenue. Now what we find is a situation where cities are counting more and more on other sources, including utility fees, such as water and sewer fees, franchise fees, state-shared revenues, including tobacco, alcohol, 911 shared revenues, which are dedicated, and gas tax revenues, which are also dedicated. Fees for service, such as building code inspections, for example, fines and forfeitures, grants from both the state and the federal government, reserves, and other locally enacted taxes or fees. City services and expenditures. I'm speaking in general terms here. What you see on this slide are the services that are provided, generally speaking, exclusively at the local level. Neither the federal government nor the state of Oregon can provide these services in individual communities. Generally speaking, the property tax supported cities commonly are the property tax-supported services commonly are police, fire, parks, library, planning, cemeteries, and airports for those communities that have them. And I should note that not all cities have all of the services listed here. Some of these services are in turn provided by special districts in some communities, so be aware of that. And generally speaking, there are also enterprise fund services, which include streets, code enforcement, municipal court, water, and sewer, although these can be augmented by property tax dollars in some communities as well. Clearly, in today's environment, cities face a number of challenges with regard to their revenues. A slow economy affects cities and the businesses which locate there. Also, we have a property tax system which provides for slow growing or flat revenue And at the same time, we have a dynamic of rapid increases in expenditures, some of which cities don't really have a lot of control over, including PERS, health insurance, binding arbitration, for example, and then costs of raw materials. Another example of a cost that's growing quickly are services to additional residents in high growth areas. Many expenditures, particularly the ones listed on this slide, as I mentioned, are beyond the individual control of cities to manage. And decisions about them, particularly PERS and binding arbitration, for example, happen at a state level, or there are macroeconomic forces at work. In 2000-2001, we had 110 cities that had properties in compression, and in 2001-2002, that number had climbed to 120, and 39 of those 120 cities lost more than $1,000 in revenue to the effects of compression. And the cities with properties in compression are all sizes, and they're from all over the state, from Cannon Beach to Baker City, Portland to Reedsport. So what we're finding as time goes on is that really no community is immune from the effects of what we're seeing statewide. And also we've got AV changes. And I believe that Mazin mentioned these to you when he was giving the property tax overview earlier in the legislative session. Again, we see increasing numbers of cities that are not realizing their maximum of 3% growth in assessed value of property. In 2001-2002, the number of those who weren't realizing the 3% increase in AV increased to 46 cities, and 7 of those cities actually realized a decline in their assessed value. And those cities were Boardman, Millersburg, North Powder, Pilot Rock, Tangent, and Weston.
And Michelle, AV being assessed value, of course?
Yes.
Interesting.
The League put together a survey and a report on the financial condition of Oregon cities entitled Diminishing Returns, and I did provide the executive summary for your information, and the full report is available for those folks who are interested. And let me just apologize to all of you for the really horrendous staple job on these handouts, okay? I see you all struggling with your handouts there. I apologize. It's the copier got away from me. Anyway, the report was meant as an assessment tool and as a kind of forecast for where we see the future of city finances going. In addition to looking at statistics and trends statewide, the report includes case studies of 8 cities representing all sizes and locations throughout the state. Those case study cities are Corvallis, Enterprise, Garibaldi, Brants Pass, Gresham, Prineville, and Scappoose. And I think it provides an interesting snapshot of what the situation was in 2000-2001. And the goal is to update that every 1 or 2 years with the new statistics and information that comes out, and ask those case study cities to provide us with updates on what their situation is and whether times are getting better or worse for those folks. Anyway, the findings, as you know, are here on the slide. We also made a number of predictions during the course of this study is what our future will look like absent any major change in policy decisions, or absent any major tax reform, or absent any major changes to those cities at the local level in terms of local revenue raising ideas or cost cutting measures. So, and the predictions if all factors remain static, are that assessed values will continue to be relatively flat and even decline in some cities, as we've already seen, due to the effects of the economy and property tax limits. A growing number of communities will be reaching their Measure 5 limit of $5 per 1,000 of real market value for schools and $10 per 1,000 of real market value for all other governments. Local option levies are oftentimes a temporary solution. The operating levies expire after 5 years, and competition among taxing districts for local option levies. We're seeing a lot more of that, particularly in general fund elections, where the double majority requirement is not an additional hurdle that folks have to overcome. We also did a number of sort of assessment tools for individual cities that we've entitled as distress signals, and we're finding that as time goes on, more and more communities are finding themselves in a distressed state, and obviously the more of these criteria a city finds that it meets, generally the more distressed their financial condition is. And there were 15, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. You have them all printed out in your handouts, but there you go. Okay. And lastly, I just want to stress to folks that what you do really matters to local communities. There are a number of things that you have the opportunity to influence one way or the other. For instance, property tax policy reform and exemptions. The state does not collect property taxes at this time, but only the legislature has the ability to make property tax exemptions for that matter. And the Constitution has pretty well set into stone property tax rates, so we don't have a lot of flexibility there. Tax exemptions are enacted at the state level, as I mentioned, but the consequences of those, both good and bad, in terms of any economic stimulus that they might provide or any revenue loss that might be experienced by the local community, are felt primarily locally. Preemption of local decisions is also a major issue. As we discussed, cities do have home rule authority and are the government closest to the people. Local decisions do reflect local priorities, and we urge that when you're considering whether to preempt local decisions, please ask the question, what is the vital state interest in doing so? Whom will it benefit? We would suggest that only if there is an overriding state interest should the state consider taking the place of 238 city councils and 36 county commissions. PERS is another area where the state sets policy that affects the rest of us at the lower levels of government. As most of you know by now, once a public employer enters PERS, they cannot opt out. So we definitely need your help in terms of controlling costs associated with the system and defining reasonable benefit levels. Binding arbitration is another issue where you could certainly be of help. We hear a lot about this at the local level, and in some cases have situations where fire departments in small communities are being compared with much larger ones in other areas of the state. And only the legislature has the ability to make the policy decisions that statutorily necessary to guide that process. Procedural changes and reporting requirements in land use, public contracting, and other areas have the potential to cost or save dollars for our local governments and, by extension, the taxpayers. So we ask that you keep this in mind as you consider changes in policies and procedures. And, of course, probably the most important message today. Mm-hmm. There you have it. And if anyone has any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Michelle. Yes, question, Representative Farr.
Thank you. On your list of distress signs for cities,
yes.
That's quite a list. coming from city government, I recognize a lot of those distress signals.
Yes.
But there's one that I don't see there, and I wonder if you could comment on that. My hometown, which is Eugene, has suffered a significant loss of employers.
Mm-hmm.
Due to, they typically cite either no land to relocate or overlapping regulations. I'm very familiar with the situation in Eugene where we've lost many large employers or in the process of losing many more large employers. Is this something that is happening throughout the state?
I think we haven't necessarily, these are the 15 most common.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly I think I want to say that generally the larger the city, the more, I hate to use the term sophisticated, but in terms of quality of life issues and land use decisions, and larger the city generally, the more they would have their own building codes, departments, inspections, et cetera. So I don't know that it's necessarily a situation that is occurring throughout the state, but I don't think either that it is exclusive to the city of Eugene.
Yeah, the city of Eugene is in the process of losing thousands and thousands of jobs, a lot of them to Springfield. Springfield's happy about that.
So,
you mentioned preemption.
Mm-hmm.
In general, I'm against preemption, but if I recognize that something that a locality is doing is causing a stressful economic situation, that's the only time I think I would be willing to look at preemptions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if I may, I
yes.
again, I think that in a lot of cases you'll find that situations such as that are in many ways self-correcting, to an extent, because as I mentioned, our locally elected leaders are elected every 2 to 4 years, and sometimes you see results of that at the ballot box, as well as major overhauls in plans and policy decisions. I don't want to speak for the city of Portland, but for instance, I know that they are in the midst of reevaluating and trying to streamline all of their city business processes as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Mayor, I'm sorry, Representative Virgil.
Michelle, one of the things that, and it's here somewhere, but I just don't know quite where, and that's franchise fees. You have it under revenue.
Right.
But under what you do matters, where do you see franchise fees?
I definitely see them as being very important. Thank you for the question. Controlling the city right-of-way is increasingly important. As you know, a lot of cables, et cetera, are under the ground and in city rights of way, and additional street cuts degrade pavement, et cetera. So that's a major issue, and closely linked to that is franchise fees. And franchise fees are basically a charge for the use of that right of way. So it is very important to cities, and you may very well see bills with regard to that this session, and I would ask you to consider those very carefully.
Any other questions? As we, of course, do all of our bills. All right. Thank you very much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Pleased to have you with us. Do we go to counties next?
Counties next.
Gil, please come forward and bring your guests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm pleased to be accompanied today by two experienced and talented county commissioners who will make the presentation. To my immediate right is Commissioner Jean Cowan from Lincoln County, who's our AOC treasurer. And to her right is Commissioner Tony Hyde from Columbia County, who's our current president. And handling the high-tech business is Philip Bransford behind us here. So with that, Tony will kick it off, and Jean will join in a little bit later, and then we'll be happy to answer questions throughout. So,
before you start, I want to just comment on your stapling job. Very nicely done.
Thank you.
not so sure Michelle heard
that. Well, good morning, members of the committee. And again, for the record, I am Tony Hyde, commissioner from Columbia County and current president of the Association of Oregon Counties. We're going to be talking about 3 points over and over again today. And with the overview, I'd like to point out that those 3 points are diversity requires a flexible approach. We are a very diverse group of counties. We provide many services through an important county-state partnership and in fact, a federal partnership as well. As Jean will point out in her graph, Oregonians hold the state and the counties responsible for delivering these critical services, and they make little distinction between counties and states. And I've used this analogy before, and I'll use it again. In terms of the citizens on the ground, it really makes little difference to them whether we're the bow or the stern or the hull or the midsection. We are the good ship government. Collectively, and that's the way the citizens see us. Who are the Oregon's 36 counties? We serve the same 3.5 million Oregonians. We have no shared constituency. We cover the same 97,060 acres or square miles. We maintain over 27,000 miles of roadway, which is roughly four times more than ODOT maintains. And again, you know, the public makes no distinction when they come off of a county road into a city road or onto a state road. For the most part, if they're in Columbia County, they're Columbia County's roads. We admitted 192,200 suspected offenders in our jails in the year 2002. And this is really the entry point for the statewide correctional system. Oregon's counties collected over $6 billion in property taxes in the last 2 years. We are the collection system for all property taxes. And we administer the system for all taxing districts in the state. We impose a variety of local taxes for local services. These local taxes are really driven, as you well know, for local impacts and local issues. And they require the support and ratification of the local citizens at the ballot box. And this is really an important piece for us and for the cities as well. This is how we collect the impacts for law enforcement through law enforcement levies. And this is how we can collect the extended impacts even for school districts when it comes to local construction. So it makes a big difference for us. And Jean, you're going to talk about shared county services.
I'll do that. Thank you. Again, for the record, I'm Jean Cowan, Lincoln County Commissioner. And I'd like to take a few moments now to sort of walk you through the connectivity that we see between state and county in five areas of service delivery, particularly general government, public safety, health, land use and transportation, economic development, natural resources and recreation. We've outlined the various functions in some separate areas for you. First of all, those functions that are operated by you, the ones that the state does alone. And those are fairly limited in our whole graph as we look through the connectivity issues. Secondly, we have a section of services that show that as a public agency, these are the ones that we deliver locally for you. They are best described as shared services. We have our countywide boundaries encompass all of the shared constituencies that we represent, both cities and counties, because our service deliveries are a bit different than our city partners. You can read the list. It's quite extensive, but I'm going to just highlight a couple of areas because health is the arena that I probably have the most involvement in. For example, in aging services, there's lots of discussion right now around the programs that the State Department of Human Services are offering to seniors, and those mostly are services that are delivered locally and are supplemented locally. Often for us, they're through regional configurations, plus county augmentation of outreach services and some other things. So we're very intertwined in that area, as we are in the arena of public health. We rely on the state services, labs, tracking, that sort of thing. They're critical for us to be able to do our job. But then we come back to on-the-ground sorts of things, communicable disease, prevention, outreach, education, treatment, if, heaven forbid, it's necessary to treat an outbreak of communicable disease. Those are the things that are provided by our local health department. So we're very much intertwined as we work through these shared services. And then we have a few items that we've sort of added on that are things that we do alone to meet the needs of our citizens. And these are, as was mentioned in the city's presentation, they're sort of different from county to county. Some of us have libraries, and in some areas those are mostly cities' arenas. So those vary a little bit, but they're the ones that we consider our responsibility to take care of. You'll note some asterisks, I can't say that word, for, you know, those little star things on there. Currently, there's a lot of focus on education. And what we thought we'd do here was to highlight some of the areas of state and county functions that directly support the school system. And I think that that's really important for us to think about. Certainly, assessment and taxation, if we weren't there collecting the revenues, those revenues that do go to schools wouldn't be there. But more it's a service delivery sort of thing. Juvenile services, the mental health programs that we provide in school, certainly public health, immunizations, all of those kinds of things are important adjuncts to the education system. And ASC has been trying to sort of find ways to deliver shared services a little more efficiently, if you would. And that's what the yellow project areas indicate. Those are some project areas that we've been engaged with jointly in many cases with state agencies in exploring options for doing things a little bit differently, and hope to come back with some recommendations. Moving on to our county revenue sources, we'd like to highlight for you today that about 40% of our revenues come from the state in terms of transfer payments and reimbursements for services that we provide locally to our shared constituents. Certainly property tax is important to us, but we also can't continue to function efficiently without those shared revenues. What you can't see on this slide, but I just wanted to point out, is that when we add in the federal transfer payments for those same sorts of services, about 50% of all county revenues come from the state or federal sources. And that's the reason that it's really significant. You see significant changes and reductions in county staff and ability to deliver services when we're impacted by the kind of reductions that have been necessary at the state level locally. Overall, our county expenditures, our two biggest areas of expenditures, are human services and public safety. And wow, isn't that a surprise? Those are two of your big three as well. So I guess we know where governmental spending is going. The last slide that I'd like to talk about is from the Legislative Revenue Office, and you've seen it before. It compares income tax and property tax, income tax being, of course, the state's primary resource, revenue source, and property tax being the county's, or at least half of ours. Property tax is much more stable, but it grows far less, and in these days with limitation, way less than we once experienced. And income tax is certainly more elastic, but it's got the ups and downs that we're all dealing with right now.
Okay. And finally, we have a few, and we're going to try and keep this short with the anticipation that there will be questions. The state government benefits from local authority. The use of local authority reflects local values, as I said earlier, processes and economies. The public holds local governments accountable for the collection and, more importantly, the use of local taxes, not the least of which is our own preemptions through enterprise zones and urban renewal districts. State government benefits from unfettered, innovative local taxing authority that is best fit to local communities. Any preemptions that exist or come across our tables erode our ability to minimize the value that we provide in the state service delivery system that we share, as is dramatically shown by Commissioner Cowan. Requirements for continuing state-county partnership. This is relatively self-explanatory, and I'm not going to bore you by reading it. Continue the distribution of joint revenue, including cigarette tax, gas tax, and other highway user fees, video lottery, beer, wine, and liquor receipts. And finally, no erosion of local revenue capacity, including preemption of local revenue authority, unless an alternative source of revenue is identified. Fund legislatively granted exemptions of local revenue sources, and no unfunded mandates as required by the Oregon Constitution. These are really important for us to be able to continue the state shared delivery system that we now enjoy.
Well, we appreciate you being here. I think I'm going to start out with a question, and then we'll have others ask you anything they would like to. One on your on your expenditure chart. I'm not getting to it for some reason. I didn't see parks on county.
Okay.
Estimated county expenditures, all funds.
Okay. I'm probably not pulling up that specific question. It's a fairly small, Representative Bridger, a fairly small expenditure for counties in many ways, and it may not have made the cut, if you will, in terms of trying to deliver a pie chart to you. But I know many of us have a similar experience background, and like you and like Tony, I too come out of city government, and we work together in terms of what city parks can be provided and what county parks can be provided. But overall, it's not a huge piece of our county expenditure. I'm in Lincoln County, so many of the parks that my citizenry enjoy, bless your hearts, are state parks because of all of our Oregon beaches, of course. Most of our parks, and those are the ones I'm most familiar, are Lincoln County, our small marine parks, and much of the upkeep does come from an assistance with the State Marine Board. That's how we occasionally get to build new restrooms in our parks and that sort of thing. But it's a relatively minor piece of our overall budget, and we also enjoy some revenue. Those who have overnight lodging facilities, we kind of balance that out. So I don't know if I answered your question, but
I feel that county parks are a real important part.
Absolutely.
Of our state, and many, many people enjoy going to the county parks and taking their families, and Oregonians enjoy the same thing. And so when I was looking at your expenses, then I missed county parks, and I also am sorry that road section is not bigger in your pie. Because I think that's another thing, that it's very nice when we can keep the county roads up to the same level as some of our city streets actually fare better, I think, when you're traveling around the state than the county roads. And so those are just my observations. But
if I might finish out
sure.
your conversation, you certainly will see them noted on the list of shared services. County parks and roads, of course, are a major part of what we do. But we're finding, I know at the local level, that the challenges of meeting public safety needs and health and human services needs are moving so far up the spectrum. Over half of our general fund budget goes to public safety in general anymore, that while we consider those things very important and we do our best to find grants and ways to upgrade our parks on a regular basis, and certainly our roads as well, and we rely on some timber revenues to help keep those up too, they're being somewhat overshadowed by the pressing needs and requests for services in the public safety and health and human services arenas.
Well, we certainly rely on you. We fill your courthouses, and in case of a disaster, national disaster, I can see that it would be the county health clinics that would be doing a lot of the inoculations and various things and playing an important part. So I'll open it to other questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. Good presentation. Thanks very much. Like Representative Verger, I'm from city government too, and I think in Lane County we have a pretty good coordination between counties and cities. Question for you: the road number that you have there, the 193.3, that includes the money that's passed through to cities for city street maintenance.
I'm not absolutely sure of that number.
I am, Madam Chair, Representative Farr. I don't believe that does. This is our county road fund, and I share your concern, Representative Berger, that number is not larger. Yes. It's a real issue for us. What we hear about most, frankly, are potholes and parks, and they're very close to people's hearts in our county. So, although they're not as large as they should be, we certainly hear enough about them.
Follow up. Thank you.
In
Lane County, if there is one bone of contention between the cities and the county, it's that the county doesn't distribute enough of the state road money to the cities. In your counties, do you experience any of that bickering?
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Farr, actually, no. We have not had that sort of conflict in Lincoln County. And at this point, I, rather than speaking for counties across the state, I have to speak for what I'm most familiar with. We have a very good working relationship and collective issues. For Lincoln County, our biggest problem, frankly, is that most of our major roadways are state highways, and they are our main streets as well. And so our challenge is working collectively, cities and counties, with the state.
And I was thinking specifically of Newport, and the main arterials there, of
course,
state highways.
Would you like me to discuss Highway 20 and Highway 101 any further?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I would say the same thing. In Columbia County, we have Highway 30 going through all but one community as their main street, and that's Vernonia, and it has Highway 47 as their main street. So we don't have collective bickering over road monies. In fact, we've got a very good partnership in our county through the urban growth boundary agreements that we're putting together with all of the cities with respect to city-county roads and how that transition takes place.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regard to the pie chart, which is obviously an averaging from the 36 counties, was there great divergence, or is that pretty much representative of all the counties?
Madam Chair, Representative Hobson, this is the total funds during that particular year based on county audit reports. The one thing we want to leave, one idea we want to leave with the committee is the diversity of the counties and their various needs. I would suspect, though, that it's fair to say that every county spends a large proportion, if not most of its funds, on public safety and health functions. Some of that, of course, is passed through money from the is transferred money from the state. But in terms of how close this is, how representative this is of every county, I suspect there's a good deal of variety as well.
May I follow up on that just a bit? As I was looking at the pie chart, I think that what might be skewed a little bit in my mind from when I look at how I manage my county budget, and this pie chart reflects all funds that come into the county and then how they're divided up. For many of us, because of the nature of the some of the funds that come in, we focus more on our general fund and what it is that we have flexibility to do. And when you get into that area, general fund alone, taking the road fund out of the picture, that sort of thing, then you have probably over 50% in most counties going into public safety and another large chunk into health and human services and the rest of it trying to be divided by everything else that we have flexibility to do. But the dedicated funds are also reflected in this chart, and then that sort of spreads it out a little more broadly.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Hodgson?
No, that helps.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. in the same vein, certainly the state, and I presume if this chart had been run every year for the last five or six, that health and welfare piece would be getting to be a bigger and bigger number over time in terms of the amount of money spent in this arena. Can you give me a picture of how much of that piece comes through transfers through state funds, or how much might come from local sources?
I would go over the 50% number in terms of transfer payments in that arena. There is a significant difference between counties when you get into the amount of county general fund money that goes into the health and human services arena. Particularly in mental health, much of what we do is based on transfer payments, and for me, the Oregon Health Plan is critical to my being able to maintain the kind of mental health services that we have in Lincoln County right now, and the reason for some of the losses in crisis management services. In the arena of public health, that's where we find ourselves needing to supplement significantly to maintain public health levels, and that varies from county to county, but it's been generally fairly stable throughout the years from my county general fund input into public health services. And then the rest of what we can do varies depending on the kinds of fundings that become available. Those, again, are what we often refer to as silo funding or dedicated funds. I get some money to do tobacco cessation or whatever else, and I can't use it for anything else, so that grows and shrinks depending on the availability of that kind of opportunity, if I'm making any sense.
You are. Thank you.
In the essence of time, I'm going to thank you very much today for your testimony, and very nice seeing you, Commissioner.
Thank you for having us.
I'd like to invite those that are here to testify for the special districts to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I was sitting in the second row with my colleague from the League of Cities, and so we decided that as the percentage of property tax revenue collections increases, the more sophisticated the presentation becomes. Heard who is on an overhead. Gil has his PowerPoint. I couldn't do that to save my life, so all of mine is on paper, and I will also deliver it orally. I appreciate the opportunity today to present to you our perspective on local revenue issues for the small special districts. The Special Districts Association, it has a real-life association. Just like the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties, we provide many of the same services, conference training, risk management, insurance program, workers' comp, training for local budget law, elections training, and we also have a legislative program, which is probably at over half of the entire association's mission is focused in the legislative arena, because we are very beholden to the action that you take. The Special Districts Association, as I said, has a real-life association. They have lots of people working over there, but instead of having employees within the association represent them at the legislature, they contract that service out and have been doing so to our firm, Western Advocates Incorporated, for 9 legislative sessions. So we're almost employees, because we feel like we've might qualify for the retirement benefit one day, because we've been there for 18 years, been before this body 9 times before representing special districts. who are these special districts? What are these little creatures of government? There are approximately 800 special service districts throughout the state of Oregon. There are about 30 different types of special service districts, and they're served, as cities are, by volunteer boards of commission, boards of directors. They can either be 3 to 5 members. Some, like cemetery districts, have 3 members. Water districts have 5. And they are elected during the May election with the school boards, school board elections. Where did we come from? The legislature created us. All of our statutory authority to exist, we're truly creatures of the state of Oregon. All of our authority is only granted by this legislature. Most of our statutes, enabling statutes, can be found within ORS 198, but each special district also has their own enabling statute. Rural fire protection districts have their own. Airport districts, as Representative Virgin knows, have their own. We have an overarching statute. All of the general authority is found within that statute, and then we also have additional statutes that we need to comply with. Unlike cities and counties, we don't have any home rule authority. We won't come before you and say this is a home rule charter issue, because we don't have charters. We don't have home rule. Any power that we have is granted by the legislature. So when we hear of anything that we might lose, we get a little worked up about it. What types of districts belong to the association? As I said, there are about 30 different types of districts. Within the association, refer to the Big Six. And if there were all these other, what I call other at-large districts in the back of the room, the Big Six are sort of the big intimidating districts because there are so many of them. Rural fire protection districts do truly make up the most, comprise the most, the largest type of district within the association. Out of the 800, there are about 250 of those belong to our association. So the Big Six are rural fire protection districts, water districts, sanitary districts. Sanitary is a nice word for sewer. It's not garbage. It's not waste management. It's sewer and surface water management also. Port districts, irrigation districts, and parks and recreation districts. And as you can see from the list, we have a number of other types of districts that belong to the association, including what I like to point out is my favorite small at-large district, vector control districts, which are districts that provide pest abatement and would be essential in the case of some sort of West Nile virus outbreak. So we run the gamut of services and all over the state. Just like to talk just briefly about how our districts are funded. Many of the districts receive, for some districts, property tax revenue is truly their only source of revenue. I've listed out here where some of the districts generate their revenue, property tax or fee, and I won't belabor that, but some of the districts are more reliant on property tax revenue than others. Others don't charge any, don't levy any ad valorem property tax, and they're solely fee-based. Those tend to be our utility types of districts, like water and sewer districts. Where are these districts located in the state of Oregon? We're everywhere. We're providing services that some cities aren't providing. The city doesn't provide water service or fire protection service. In fact, rural fire protection districts are a very good example of a service that special districts provide. They're, I think, and I may be off on some within giving a margin of error of five or so, but there truly are not very many municipal fire departments anymore in the state of Oregon. There are about 17 city fire departments, and really most fire service in this state is provided by rural fire protection districts. How are these special districts staffed? Really, truly, we have one district who's providing service to at least 8 cities in the Portland metropolitan area, to Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, a very large special district, but most of our districts are small. 63% of our special districts have fewer than 5 full-time employees, and 23% of our special districts have no full-time employees, so they're solely volunteer districts, volunteer boards, volunteer employee or volunteers running the district, and that also can be witnessed in the approximately 7,000 volunteer firefighters that provide service to Oregonians for nothing to the state of Oregon. Budget size, again, some examples of very large districts would be Tualatin Valley Water District, Tualatin Valley Fire District, Clackamas County Fire District, number one. But smaller, most of our districts have annual, 63% of our districts have annual budgets that are less than $250,000 annually. 45% of our districts have annual budgets that are less than $100,000 annually. Where do we get our revenue? Again, property taxes. Despite the whole property tax limitations that have been enacted, Measure 5 and Measure 50, unlike the League of Oregon Cities referred to some shifting of revenue and revenue sources from property taxes to other sources, becoming more reliant on other sources. As a single service provider, we really only have the one service that we're providing, either water, fire, parks and recreation. And we only have the authority that you give us, so we don't have franchise fees. We don't get state shared revenue, no liquor revenue, no cigarette revenue. We're just operating on our property taxes and our revenues and our user fees and assessments and occasionally a grant or two here or there. Significant tax policy issues for districts, obviously property tax exemptions, as you can imagine, are a huge issue for our association. Enactment of any new property taxes, tax exemptions will bring us to the table, and you'll probably be very tired of hearing it, unless you choose not to take up any property tax exemptions, which would be very preferable to us, but in the event that you do, you will hear us come forward and talk to you about what it will do to certain local communities. Enterprise zones is another big issue for us. When a city or county chooses to create an enterprise zone, our property taxes are preempted. We do not have the authority to say, no, we're not going to participate in that. As those zones currently exist, our property taxes are just preempted by the creation of those zones. So expansion to enterprise zones, the types, the size, any of those types of issues, you will hear us come before you and ask for opt-out language. There was some legislation passed last session that dealt with this issue, not as it relates to enterprise zones, but to vertical housing zones, a similar type of zone, and we successfully secured that opting out language. And you'll hear, after it comes through, Representative Patty Smith's committee down the hall, the big economic development department's big bill on enterprise zones that already contains that language. We've worked very well with the department. They've really listened to our concerns and our issues and have instituted in 1999 some procedures to make sure that special districts are notified when enterprise zones are being considered to be expanded or even created, so our taxing districts do know that the potential for property tax preemption does exist. Urban renewal, out of disrespect to Representative Scott, who's probably heard about it more than he wants to hear about it and can be, it's a big issue. I just won't get into that, but it is an issue for special districts. And then, obviously, unfunded mandates are a big issue for association. Working off of, not off of this sheet, but just some other thoughts that I just would like to bring to you for your consideration. We have seen, since Ballot Measure 50's implementation, we have seen and received a lot of phone calls. We're seeing the trend that we are seeing is new district formation. Cities are calling and saying, we understand we could form a Parks and Recreation District. We will be able to keep our general fund revenue, but we could form a new district to provide this type of service. How do we go about doing that? We've seen several probably five new special districts at least in the last two or three years formed just for that because of the considerations of not being able to operate efficiently as a city because of lack of revenue, how can we still continue to provide services to our community but with a different type of government? Mainly that new district formation tends to be rural fire protection districts, parks and recreation districts, or library districts. Those seem to be the top three that we get questions about. Within our own membership, we see a lot of consolidation. Consolidation is always a difficult subject. There's a lot of turf issues and a lot of we won't have enough say if we combine with all these other water districts. How will we continue to have our own voice heard within our own community? But it is something that we are seeing more often in the Portland metro area. Sunrise Water Authority, a number of special districts have chosen to band together and try to produce some cost efficiencies and savings. And it doesn't always happen and it doesn't always work, but it is something that is getting a lot of discussion taking place at the local level within our own association about that issue. With respect to elections, Michelle touched briefly on this, the whole double majority issue and local option levies and general obligation bonds. One of the trends that we're also seeing is that districts seem to fare better at during local option levies, and I could give you some additional data if you'd like that. Special districts tend to, based upon our 2-3 year analysis of this, tend to fare better in the passage of their measures with respect to both local option measures and general obligation bond fund measures because we feel this is really truly a function of people feeling closer to a smaller type of government, and also an unfortunate function for cities where you'll have a local option measure that's on the ballot that's library, parks, and a little bit of general office maintenance support or something like that, whereas our measures are one purpose, one service, something that people can tangibly see. We're going to get a new fire truck, or we're going to put five new firefighters on the street, or what have you. We're going to build a new play structure. We have seen fairly consistently that our measures do pass. Unfortunately, the double majority seems to hinder all three of the local governments and school districts' ability to pass local measures. So, with that, I'm thankful to have been able to have this opportunity and be pleased to answer any questions you might
have. Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Minister. Excuse me. In a number of the types of organizations you represent only a portion of those organizations, like only a portion of the state's fire districts. How do you interact with the rest of the organizations that provide that service?
Madam Chair, Representative Hobson, well, for the rural fire protection districts, actually, we truly, our firm also represents the Elected Officials Association, too, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. So we really do have kind of a lock on the fire.
Bad choice.
But, for instance, the PUDs, they have their own association. We work very closely with those associations. The sewer districts have Association of Clean Water Agencies. We work with them consistently. Most of those association members in the PUDA and AQUA, they all belong to our association anyway. So we really truly value that partnership. They're able to provide us with additional expertise when we need it with issues that relate specifically to them.
And if I'm understanding you correctly, for some of these, the parent organization or the umbrella organization for a specific service also belongs to your organization.
Madam Chair, Representative Hobson, that is correct.
Thanks.
Other questions? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think that's it, Madam Chair.
All right. Then, if there's no other business to come before the body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.
Thank you.